Welcome to The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. This is our first show, and we're excited to bring you a series of intelligent, thought-provoking interviews with Utah's business leaders each week on this program. Today, we are speaking with Patrick Byrne, founder and CEO of Overstock.com. Under Patrick's leadership, Overstock has grown to over $1 billion a year in sales, employs nearly 1,500 Utahns, and is one of the top five most visited internet mass merchandise sites in the United States. Welcome to KCPW, Patrick, and thank you for joining us.
Doug, it's an honor to be on.
So that's quite a list of accolades there, which you've done with Overstock.com.
Much sound and fury signifying nothing.
Well, it's a long journey. You've been there for 15 years. And what I'd like to do is turn back the clock, if I could, and go back to 1999 when you and a group of investors purchased, I believe, 60% of a company called D2, Discounts Direct. My understanding is at the time, D2 was sending fax blasts out to flea market operators, letting them know about liquidation deals and doing less than $2 million a year in sales. When you look back at where you were then and you were considering buying D2, what was your vision for the company?
Well, it was that we could take basically the flea market, take what they had and put it online. Now, they had failed. The thing that I probably left out of, they had gone under. And so we bought it sort of in the scrapyards, and we bought a majority stake for a few million bucks. And now they did have a website, but it was only an informational website. They weren't really able to do transactions and send orders to warehouses and stuff. So the vision was, I'll give you the rubber meets the road vision. I knew a guy in high school named Charlie that whatever you wanted, this guy would be like, yeah, I know a guy in the factory. I'll get it for you real cheap. And we never really understood where he got his stuff. And he gradually, as I got to know him, I learned he really did just have connections everywhere in warehouses. And so I realized for the consumers who don't know their own Charlie, what we could have is a company of those kind of bada bing, bada boom sort of fellows wheeling and dealing and making these special deals and for bankruptcies and liquidations. And we could bring it into a warehouse in Salt Lake, put it all online. So that was basically the vision.
Interesting. And so it's one thing for a college student that has a good idea to say, you know, I want to pursue this. I want to go forward. In your case, you were out of college. You were about 37, 35 at the time, and you had a great job, right? You were running a Berkshire Hathaway Warren Buffett company. You left that, what I would call a prestigious job, in order to pursue this other idea. What did that decision look like? How hard was it for you to decide to do that?
It was kind of funny. I was working for Mr. Buffett when this started, although I was on the verge of retirement. I was about a month away from retirement. I had run some other small companies. I'd run a machine shop in New Hampshire. I was getting ready to sell it. And I was at a point where I could retire, and I thought I would go teach. And in fact, I did take a teaching position with Dartmouth College. But this idea had come through, this business plan about the flea market, and really seeing it from the theoretical perspective rather than just the rubber meets the road perspective, the theoretical perspective, it seemed like the best idea, you know, other than eBay to come along. And that was that the real way to see Overstock is this. The mainstream American retail system is set up for three things. They want mass quantities, similar goods, small number of suppliers. Goods become available from bankruptcies, from liquidations, from canceled orders, and a truck turns over on a route somewhere or something. And you get these small amounts, 200 of this, 50 of that. And the mainstream retail system doesn't want it. And it doesn't really work for mainstream retail. So the idea was set up a supply chain, at the risk of being a bit technical, set up a supply chain that could deal in these very small lots of disparate products, widely scattered, and by bringing them into one warehouse and putting them online, you sort of had one massive store. And it just gnawed at me that that wasn't getting done, that seemed like such a good use of the internet and something that it wasn't the way other e-tailers were approaching their businesses. And they were basically just saying, taking a conventional store and saying, let's create an online version. It was just a niche. It was gnawing at me that nobody was doing that. So after I taught just one semester, I came back to really get to take over this company, and which had failed, and everyone was being fired, and I stepped in and recapitalized it and had a group of investors come in. And I really only thought I'd be here 3 to 6 months. And then it just, that was October 99. And actually it had done $500,000 the year before and actually was on a just, it was literally the day they were closing that we stepped in and bought it. And relaunched it a couple months later with a website, overstock.com. And then I found I couldn't leave. It just got too exciting.
Interesting. So 1999, it was really an idea to these discontinued products, these oversupplied products as a way to get that out so that the average person that didn't know Joey on the street to get a super deal had access to that. And I can see where the internet would be a great channel for that. But if we look at Overstock today, you're really primarily now first run brand name products. And how did that pivot? How did that business change? How did you guys make that decision along the way?
Great question. Well, we started off with the Overstock, just as you explained it, and it's generally understood. Then we started realizing we could buy excess inventory, but not straight inventory, but rather time on, say, in factories in Taiwan, that they might have a slow season, 6 weeks they're down, they don't have any orders. They'd be willing just to keep the lights on in their factory to, in a sense, sell us their excess time in their factory and let us buy products very, very cheaply, just so they didn't have to fire everyone. They could. So in a sense, we went from buying overstock inventory to overstock time in factories. And then that just gradually emerged as our supply chain got so efficient and we got really quite good at doing the most difficult thing to do, which is the overstock stuff. We started just morphing into, we started realizing we could carry first-run goods, inline goods, and they started working in our system too. So you're right, we gradually expanded. We're over a million products now, and it isn't. In fact, I think the name Overstock has constrained us. It started off as a great advantage to have a self-explanatory name, and it saved us a ton of money in marketing from the beginning. But now I'm afraid I think that a lot of customers have this perception of us as, well, we're like a Big Lots, and it is just, you know, old goods, retired goods, goods they couldn't sell somewhere else, and they don't know that we are carrying first-run
brands. It's an interesting problem because I agree with you. The name is not necessarily descriptive of what the business is today,
right.
But yet it's got a great brand name. It's got a lot of brand equity associated with it. So there's another difficult decision for you and your board going forward.
That's a pivot coming up someday.
And I know in Europe you don't use the name overstock.com, right? It's o.co.
Correct. You've done your homework. Yeah, around the world it's just o.co. And it's because you can't build a global brand around the name Overstock. You could around Amazon because Amazon is Amazon no matter what language you're in. But Overstock, it doesn't work for international. So we are o.co internationally.
Now, you just bring up a good point. I mean, your industry is brutally competitive. You just mentioned Amazon.com.
Hyper competitive.
Yeah, I can't think of many businesses that are more competitive than what you're in. Most of your competitors have gone out of business, which is the good news, right? In a competitive business.
We swept up a bunch of their inventory. 18 of the dot-coms, they went bankrupt. We stepped in and got their inventory and liquidated it.
What do you think led to your success in an area where so many others have failed?
Well, great. First, Utah. I've run various companies, both my own and for Buffett, around the country. And Utah has a really unique environment that people may not appreciate here. First of all, the idea that you can take anyone off the street and they're computer literate. Anyone who's gotten out of a Utah high school is comfortable on a computer. And that was true 12, 13 years ago. You can't take that for granted. In other states I've worked in, you can't. I mean, people come in off the street and you have to show them what a mouse is and how you use a mouse. I mean, it's really basic. So just the fact that Utah was quite prescient in the 1980s about building computer science at the University of Utah and at BYU and the high school. So a part of it is Utah. We attracted a fantastic set of colleagues. They're kind of we're an island of misfit toys. There's a lot of people working at Overstock who had totally different backgrounds, but they came in on a lark and then they just figured something out and they've just had great careers. And I think it's that those factors coupled with our basic business model, plus we really, you know, I have Buffettism, value investing running in my veins, and value investing teaches a principle that you run a business as if you were going to run it for 20 years, no one else owns it. It's just up to you to build the most fundamentally valuable business. a lot of other guys on the internet were out there chasing the latest fad. They were chasing this and chasing that.
Looking to make a quick buck. Sell the company and get out.
Right. Bigger fool theory. I'll find some bigger fool to buy it. Not how do we build a good fundamentally sound business.
And I think that's good advice too, because you took a 20-year perspective, and it's a good thing you did, because here we are 15 years later and you're still at the helm.
So don't remind me.
You're fortunate that you did that. I want to go back to the training, what you were saying, people being computer savvy really from day one. But yet there's some skill sets that you need to have in order to succeed at your job. And I know there's a website where employees can rate their companies. You guys do very well on it. I believe it's glassdoor.com. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that your employees say that they like and they enjoy and has been valuable for them is Overstock University. Mm-hmm. What is Overstock University, and how did you come up with the idea to do that?
Well, we have a really strong – I mean, everybody says this, but we mean it. We have a really strong commitment to training and education within the company. Our payroll now is about $80 million a year is what we pay people. If you were renting a machine for $80 million a year, you would surely spend a couple few million dollars a year on mechanics and making sure it was tuned up and that you were getting all you could out of that $80 million expense. Well, similarly, we have an $80 million expense of having all these people show up to work. Why not spend a couple few million dollars a year making sure that they're having the best education, the best career development and personal development you can? So we spend a lot of time on, we've built a whole system of education within the company, very clear career tracks. We really try to promote from within the company, from customer care, from all over the company. There are some exceptions. Accountant, in the finance department, we need people with CPAs. And in IT, you need people who know how to write Java. But for much of the company, people have come in and customer care or some other parts and just risen within the company. So we enable that with education. We have an online, we do a bunch of courses that we've developed internally, and all our colleagues can access them from their desks, and we call that O University. And so there's hundreds of courses for them to take. And there's actually some local colleges that give credit to our people for what. And so I don't want to say in case I get it wrong. There's one that is taking credit and one that's thinking of it. And I'm afraid of getting them mixed up.
Well, we'll leave that for another time.
Okay.
But Overstock University clearly is one of the ways with 1,500 employees, you have to think about how do you indoctrinate folks into your culture. How do you have a common goal, a common vision that everybody knows about? And talk to us about how you've done that. When you started the company, there were fewer than a dozen people. Mm-hmm. Now, as I said, there's 1,500 employees. How do you make sure that everybody knows what the culture is and, as importantly, knows what the goal of the company is?
Well, there's very good orientation up front, first of all, that tries to get everybody, dipped in the Overstock sauce and understand understand our ethic, which is as corny as it sounds, it's sort of being straight, old-fashioned. The first rule in the employee handbook is if you ever lie to the company or to a colleague, you're fired. And we're really not hang-em-high people, but we don't have time for politics. We don't have time for deceit, anything like that. And people who come in with those kinds of big company-itis attitudes stick out like sore thumbs. So part of it is just being able to filter those people out who don't get it. And then we have a lot of contact. We have we're constantly putting out videos and stories, and there's a lot of – we have a very flat structure, I would put it that way. So there's
which is hard to do with 1,500 employees.
Boy, it's hard. It's hard, and it's just the nature of things that they want to – that they want to get bureaucratized and turned into tall hierarchies. And my job is constantly fighting that trying to come up with institutions that can get the job done without it just being – the last thing you want is the Dilbert cartoon strip where there's a pointy-haired manager in a corner office thinking he knows everything, issuing orders. That's not how you can operate this kind of a company, especially. You shouldn't operate any company that way. But so it's all about giving our colleagues the training they need and the information they need to make good decisions and then measuring them on their decisions. But pushing a lot of that authority and decision-making out to the frontier and not – it doesn't sit with me.
Right. You were talking about academics. You have an unusual background yourself for somebody leading a tech company. I know you've got a PhD in philosophy, I believe, from Stanford University.
Right.
How did that background help you in what you're doing today?
Well, it helped me fantastically. I mean, for the Stanford Philosophy Department was super for me, and spent many years there in and out of their hallowed halls. First of all, at the most basic level, you learn a you build some tremendous intellectual muscles. When you're doing philosophy or any sort of liberal arts degree, you're learning to read critically. You're learning to write, learning to speak persuasively. You're learning, you know, a whole bunch of skill sets. You're learning to tease about apart arguments and see where the actual contradiction between two people is. That's all a bunch of skills that really serve you well in business. So I think of that as like you're at the gym and you're building great muscles, and then one day you get to go out actually on the field and play football, and you've spent all your life in the gym. Beyond that, I think that philosophy has really helped me. I can give whole talks about all these things I learned in the study of philosophy that I then applied to business, but often it's happened in some intuitive sense. Like I had some idea later and started it, and only looking back did I see, wait a second, the reason I had that idea is because of some course I took or some book I read 25 years ago.
Yep. I think many educational endeavors, the basic foundation is broken. My undergrad's in a science degree. I'm an engineering undergrad. And I envy a lot of the folks that have the liberal arts background. And I think just being in an engineering program or just being in a liberal arts program, I think it's a shame that you have to choose one or the other. I think much better would be to blend the two.
Absolutely. The people, I love hiring people with liberal arts degrees, but the truth is it's somewhat hit or miss. I mean, I love somebody comes in with a history degree or English or literature or philosophy. First of all, you know that they have the horsepower, but sometimes they just can't get it together to work in sort of in a fairly structured environment at a specific job. Where on the other hand, if somebody comes in with a straight science degree, there are some things they don't seem to be able to figure out, and it's kind of interesting. And there's things that the liberal arts people can't do, and so the best of both worlds is a combination. Somebody who has studied math, computer science, some kind of engineering, some kind of science degree, but who is also open and has the feel for, doesn't have to think in such a linear, rigid sequence, but can actually interpret the world or experience the world as a consumer might, or they can put themselves in someone else's shoes.
Well, and I know the whole educational system is going through pretty dramatic changes, I think, just like your business is much different today than it was 15 years ago. I think the university education 15 years from today, watch out for it, folks, because it's coming, is going to be very different than it is. And hopefully this blend of the best of both worlds becomes part of that.
Absolutely.
I want to go back to the topic of hiring good people. And I know you were fortunate enough to be able to recruit your father to be on the board of directors at Overstock.com. And for folks that don't know, your father's a very accomplished business. I know he just passed away last year.
Right.
My condolences. But he was a very accomplished business person himself. There's a very famous Warren Buffett company that most listeners have heard of called Geico.
Right.
And your father took over Geico at a time when they were very close to getting shut down.
Right.
He had to take some pretty major changes. Rumor is he had to fire like a fourth of the workforce.
Oh, much more than that. He went from 10,000 to 3,000 employees, had to fire 70%.
Wow. And this was all before Buffett became an investor. And it was really through your father's hard work that Geico got on the radar screen of Buffett's attention. And Buffett ultimately ended up investing. I wanted to ask you, what business skills, what business philosophies did you learn from your father?
Oh, well, I learned my father and Buffett, and it's crazy name dropping, but I had among my many tailwinds in life, first would be my mom, but after them, I would put Buffett and my dad, and just fabulous teachers. I grew up learning business principles and learning how to do things. My father was an actuary by background, but what he really was a wonderfully garrulous Irish storyteller. And he was just a real natural leader. He also, people gravitated to him. He tended to be able to get things done with soft power. Sometimes he had to be hard power, like when he took a company from 10,000 down to 3,000.
That was pretty tough, right?
That was pretty tough.
That was tough management.
Buffett had an interesting analysis of that. And oddly enough, Buffett in the early 50s, as a very young man, had shown up at Geico and had actually been a shareholder at Geico, but then sold out. And you're right, in 1976, Geico had failed and it was on the verge of bankruptcy. And they hired my dad and he went, it was the first time he ran a company. And he, Buffett later described it as the cancer model, that there's a sort of unique kind of leader who can see an organization that is on the verge of death and figure out, well, if you cut out, what can we cut out so that what we leave can still hang together and stay alive? And it takes a kind of a, well, it takes a certain mindset, Buffett said, to be able to do that. And my father was the, you know, had that mindset par excellence. He could take an organization from 10,000 down to 3,000 in it, but what instead of it failing with 10,000, he created a beautiful, prosperous company with 3,000, and it grew its way back over the years.
You see it all the time, right, where people make cuts, but unfortunately they make cuts too deep, or they make cuts in the wrong department, and they make things worse, not better.
Yep, and it's happened. You know, we've certainly stumbled on few occasions in the 14, 15 years, and you know, there have been times we've had to do layoff, and they break my heart. They're hard, and they're especially hard because I know it's general. It's always been from some mistake I made led us to be in this situation where we've got to cut 200 people, and it's a terrible situation to be in. I've been in it a few times since we started, but you just have to – the companies that are still here are the ones who have the – you know, who can hitch up their pants and do that when they have to do it. But it's a horrible feeling, especially knowing that I'm the guy who made the mistake that made us shrink 20%, and so we had to lay people off.
Right, right. And unfortunately, that's the reality of business, right? You do the best you can. Nobody's going to bat 1,000. And speaking of batting 1,000, Buffett's got a great quote about your dad that I'm sure you've heard, but I want to share with our audience. Buffett called your father the Babe Ruth of insurance.
Right.
That is quite a compliment coming from Warren Buffett. And I know your dad, as I mentioned earlier, was also on your board of directors. And I'm sure there were times where you and he disagreed on an important decision that needed to be made or an important view for the company. How did that resolve itself? And what advice, if any, would you have for other business leaders that are thinking about putting a family member that's an accomplished business person and deserves to be on the board? But what cautions might you have for people thinking about bringing a family member into a high-level position like that for their company?
I would say it's important to be clear of the distinction between the roles. So, for example, I think that chairman and CEO should be split. It shouldn't be the same person. It happens to be the same person now, me. I trust myself, but it's not the right institutional design. And someday, I think sooner rather than later, you'll see us get a chairman because I don't think the position should be held by the same person, the positions of chairman and CEO. And the chairman's duties are different, and they're really to manage the board, to manage the capital structure of the business, and most importantly, to decide when to pull the trigger and fire the CEO. And that's really
spoken like somebody that's been on both sides of that equation. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, that's what they do. They're not there. It's not a committee trying to run the company. Now, if you don't take steps or you don't remember that, sometimes boards of directors start thinking of themselves as the committee who's making the strategic choices. You don't want that. On the other hand, they represent the owners. We probably have 6,000 owners, a lot of them little, you know, widows and orphans, as they're called on Wall Street, who have given us their capital. We're the steward of their capital. And they have a right to have representatives to whom I have to go and answer every 3 months and explain my decisions. But it's also got to be clear that those representatives aren't, you know, they can decide to get rid of me anytime they want. But they're supposed to have an intelligent conversation with me and my colleagues and make us smarter. But that's really their function. It's not the board of directors isn't running the company. So I'd say that as long as you're clear on that distinction and roles, you can work with family members. But it's important to get it very, very clear up front.
You're recently in the news quite a bit. by your decision to be the first major online retailer to start accepting Bitcoins. And just prior to coming to the studio for our conversation today, I saw your organization put out a note. You just $1 million in total sales via Bitcoins?
Correct, since January 9th. I had been expecting to do maybe $3 million this year. I now think it's going to be $10 to $15 million this year, and it's growing quickly.
Yeah, that you know that's amazing, and you've gotten a lot of press out of that as well. So I think, like you said, with the auction site, with the Big O commercial, some of these decisions have tangential benefits that are hard to predict ahead of time.
Right.
Which is one of the things with entrepreneurship, right? I mean, I consider you still an entrepreneur, even though you're running a company with $1 billion. One of the things is it's easy ahead of time to think about all the things that could go wrong.
Right.
But as easy as that is, it's equally difficult to predict all the things that are going to go right that you couldn't have thought about ahead of time.
All right. So it's, you're right. And we certainly have had lucky breaks here and there. I think it's, unless you can tell the future, you're not going to be able to really pick out all the pitfalls and opportunities. So the trick is really having a nimble structure.
You're 15 years into Overstock.com.
Oh, yeah.
The company that it is today, I think, would have been hard to imagine for the 37-year-old young man that started it. As you look at the next 15 years, what do you hope Overstock becomes during that period of time?
Well, I do hope it grows from, say, we'll probably do $1.5 billion this year. I'd like to see it grow to, you know, the $5 to $10 billion range. It's nicely profitable now. I'd like to see the profits growing. But really, what I'm getting a kick out of is figuring out ways we can use this Overstock platform to introduce new businesses that work as businesses but are also good for the world. So, for example, since you ask, I'm going to throw something out that's going to sound like a cheap plug. But in a few weeks, we're turning on a new tab on our site for pet adoption. And it will be the best pet adoption experience on the internet. We have thousands of little, you know, pet shelters sending us their data. We're running it through the same world-class technology that lets you sort through 1 million toasters and blankets and wallets to find, you know, the watch that you want. You're going to be able to do on our site, you know, saying I live in this zip code, I want to look within 50 miles for a dog that's under 6 months old, that's a chocolate lab or something. And it will filter out all the hundreds of thousands of pets and shelters around the country down to the few that meet your requirements. So that's one example. We have a farmer's market. Going to first online farmer's market is coming live in April. And it's going to be a beautiful experience. We're starting off with Winder Farms here in Utah, if you know Winder Farms. Basically, we're going to bring that kind of service to the whole country. So I have a lot of fun. At this point, my job is institutional design. I'm not out there hiring and firing and going through spreadsheets. I'm designing the institutions within the company. And I'm getting to kind of come up with ideas like this, and I find it really satisfying.
I can see that. And it's also fun. You're still a young man. You're 52, 53, 51.
Yeah.
So you've got a long time for creative ideas like that.
From your lips.
I'm a big fan of the pet adoption space as well, so I'm glad to hear you guys are doing that.
Thank you.
Patrick, thank you for joining us this morning. I enjoyed the conversation.
Doug, I did as well. It was great.
Our guest this morning is Patrick Byrne. He's the founder and CEO of Overstock.com. The Bottom Line is recorded at KCPW Studio at Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. I'm Doug Wells. See you next week on The Bottom Line.